can go ahead and get yourself situated. Both counsel, you'll have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for realtor, you'll have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. There is a button sort of on the center bottom of the podium that will adjust the podium up or down. You feel free to adjust it to the appropriate height. And I'll ask the marshal to call this final argument case.
Now calling A241410 in the matter of a public safety officer death benefit for Eric William Brebner.
All right, and counsel for realtor, when you're ready, go ahead and get situated at the podium and you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Rowland, and I represent the estate of Officer Grobner, who was killed in the line of duty due to a vascular rupture and coronary artery disease. His estate was improperly denied DPS killed in the line of duty death benefits. This court should reverse and remand the ALJ's order granting the Department of Public Safety summary disposition for two reasons. One, Officer Grobner was killed in the line of duty as defined in Johnson and Kramer. Two, Officer Grobner's death satisfies the vascular rupture presumption because he died of a vascular rupture within 24 hours of performing emergency response, and he died of a vascular rupture within 24 hours of performing non-routine, stressful, or physically strenuous law enforcement activities. First, this court should reverse and remand because Officer Grobner was killed in the line of duty as defined in Johnson and Kramer. In Johnson and Kramer, the Minnesota Supreme Court defined killed in the line of duty as a death that results in part from the performance of duties peculiar to public safety officers that exposes the public safety officer to the hazards of being killed. Additionally,
Mr. Rowland, if I could, I would like to understand, just to understand your arguments, are you arguing that the case law, in short, the case law applies, the statute does not apply as your primary argument, and then your second argument is an alternative argument. If we reject the first, then you're arguing that the statute's been satisfied? Or are you arguing that the two, the case law and the statute, are sort of coexist in some way?
I'm arguing that the statute and the case law coexist, and we're arguing that affirmatively Officer Grobner was killed in the line of duty based on the case law definition. Separately, he also was killed in the line of duty under the Hart presumption in the statute. Either one independently is a basis for approval of DPS benefits.
Under your view, I mean, then do we somehow kind of mesh the two together, the case law and the statute? Or, I mean, what happens to the, I mean, the statute, the statutory provision referring to vascular rupture was enacted after the case law. But if we continue to apply the case law, aren't we doing some violence to the legislature's authority to make law through legislation?
No, Your Honor. There's no disregard for the 2016 amendment that ultimately created the relevant version of the statute today. They both coexist, and it makes sense with the proper legal framework.
Okay, I'll let you proceed. Thank you.
An additional key component that was established in Johnson is that where a heart attack is resulting in part from the physical and emotional stress associated with public safety officer activities, it's not a death from natural causes. Here, Officer Grobner's estate offered an unrebutted medical opinion that he died of coronary artery disease and a vascular rupture due to the performance of duties peculiar to public safety officers that expose them to the hazards of being killed. Specifically, Dr. Harrell attributed Officer Grobner's death to the mental and physical stress of responding in his capacity as a police officer to calls involving SWAT, domestic violence, searches, high-speed vehicle chases, being attacked with a knife, and many more situations.
I'd like to ask you about the relief you're seeking. So you're saying reverse remand. For the remand portion, are you arguing remand with instructions to award benefits, or remand to do what? Have an evidentiary hearing?
We're asking for a reversal and remand of the order granting summary disposition in favor of the state, and then we're asking the court to give instruction as to the proper legal framework for the ALJ to conduct the proper legal analysis after an evidentiary hearing that involves deciding the material facts that are in dispute today that our position, the ALJ, decided in the moving party's favor for the purposes of summary disposition.
And so akin to a summary judgment, it would basically be put the case back into that posture that the summary disposition is denied and we're going to go forward with an evidentiary hearing. Is that right?
That is correct. We're asking for reversal of the summary disposition order and a remand for further proceedings.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
As well as an outline of the appropriate legal framework for the ALJ to review heart deaths in the context of Department of Public Safety benefits, as I'll go into in more detail.
Jumping forward a little bit in your argument, the word non-routine, is that modifying every other phrase that comes after in the statute? Or is it only modifying the phrase stressful or strenuous physical law enforcement?
Your Honor, it's only modifying the first clause in that series. Specifically, that would be the clause would be non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical law enforcement. It would not modify everything else in that series. And the reason this makes sense, if the legislature had intended for it to modify everything in the phrase, or excuse me, in the series, they would have done so differently with the drafting of the statute. For example, they could have added a colon after non-routine stressful to clearly indicate that that clause applied to everything in the series, or they could have done what they did in subdivision 3A1 Roman numerate 2, which would have read, if they applied the same convention, engaged in law enforcement, fire suppression, etc., and that engagement involved non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical activity. However, regardless of the interpretation of that clause, Officer Grobner still satisfies the criteria of the presumption, even if this court adopts the state's proposed interpretation of that subdivision.
Could I clarify your answer? I mean, it sounds like, I mean, Mr. Grobner was a police officer.
That's
a law,
correct.
A law enforcement officer. And so if you interpret that paragraph of the statute, the non-routine adjective to modify the words law enforcement, then it seems like it would apply to this case then, right?
In this case, in the 24 hours preceding his death, he had a 12-hour shift where he went on many emergency response calls. So the last phrase in that series would be emergency response activity. I don't believe there's any dispute that he was engaged in multiple emergency response activities in the 24 hours preceding his death.
Oh, and you're saying he was not involved in law enforcement or law enforcement activities during the 24-hour period? Is that your position?
That's not my position. He also was involved in law enforcement activities. The question involves the interpretation of how to apply that clause, stressful, strenuous, physical. Does it apply solely to law enforcement, or does it also apply to emergency response activity? And our position is regardless whether it applies to just law enforcement or both, we still meet the criteria necessary to prove the presumption.
Under your argument, then, a heart attack that occurs 24 hours after a shift, if the officer had any emergency response activity that happened in that prior shift within 24 hours, it would be recoverable. Is that right?
That is correct. If he was engaged in emergency response and he passed away of one of the three specified conditions within 24 hours of engaging that activity, it would be presumed compensable. The state could still bring competent medical evidence to the contrary to rebut that presumption. To jump into the point the court has brought up about the statutory interpretation of that section, regardless of the interpretation the court adopts, Officer Grobner's death is presumed killed in the line of duty under the statute in that section. Specifically, the ALJ erred by deciding material facts in the moving party's favor in reaching the determination that Officer Grosvenor did not qualify for that presumption. A couple of really key examples of that. One example was an emergency call that occurred at 5:34 p.m. the day prior to his death. On that call, he responded to what he knew at the time was an emergency call involving a child with a knife and reports of a frantic scene. Officer Grosvenor, we can see from the body cam footage, raced at speeds of nearly 60 miles per hour through a residential neighborhood to quickly get to this call. He would not have done this if he expected this to be routine, stress-free, or he expected it to be a calm scene. He raced to this scene because he was preparing for what could have been at the scene and what could have been entailing as that call went on. The ALJ erred by focusing on how that emergency call resolved and not on the stress related to the call on Officer Grosvenor's body that had already been incurred when he got knowledge of the call and was dispatched to that emergency call. The ALJ also erred by focusing on what could be seen visibly from Officer Grosvenor's outward appearance during the emergency call. When officers are trained to remain calm and appear calm in very stressful situations. There's also another key material fact in dispute as it gets to the presumption, and that involves the time of death. The medical examiner on the death certificate noted the time of death as 5:07 p.m. However, when the medical examiner arrived, Officer Grosvenor was already dead, and at the time, there was indication that his body was cold to the touch. The last time we know that Officer Grosvenor was confirmed alive was 9:37 a.m. of that same day. So depending on the factual determination of the appropriate time of death, it would bring in many additional non-routine stressful calls that occurred that day, specifically one, importantly, that occurred the day prior to his death at 10:07 a.m., where he was dispatched to a felony-level manhunt where they searched for the felon for 18 minutes and required canine assistance to ultimately apprehend the suspect. With this, discovery in this case also is not yet complete. We expect an officer who is on scene and participated in that same call as Officer Grosvenor to testify as to the nature of the call and especially the high stress nature of that emergency call for service. Because there are disputes of material fact, specifically as it gets to the analysis of the statutory presumption, first, whether the calls were non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical law enforcement, and the time of death, summary disposition is inappropriate, and we ask for reversal and remand for an evidentiary hearing. Next, I'm going to return to the Johnson-Kramer definitions and outline how Officer Grosvenor's death meets the existing case law definitions in Johnson and Kramer.
Mr. Rowland, before you do that, I'd like to go back to something you said just a few minutes ago. You were talking about the 534 call, and you talked about the stress of driving there at high speeds and anticipating a stressful event. You didn't discuss what occurred after he was on the scene. I mean, is it your position that what occurred after he arrived was not stressful or strenuous?
What occurred after he arrived would be an issue of fact for the fact finder to decide, but ultimately the ALJ relied on the resolution of the call, which did have a peaceful resolution as opposed to a tragic resolution that it certainly could have with the information he was provided at the beginning of that dispatch.
If you were to go to trial, what evidence would you introduce to prove that what occurred after his arrival was stressful or strenuous? And I guess, you know, in other words, I understand probably the body-worn camera and so on, but what events or incidents or actions taken by people when he was on the scene would be considered by the fact finder in determining whether or not his activity then was stressful or strenuous?
We would ask the fact finder to consider both expert testimony, which would opine on whether it meets that particular standard, as well as any relevant fact witnesses who could give more clarity to what happened on scene.
And I guess I'm trying to understand the underlying facts. In other words, what would the witnesses talk about? I mean, What would be the substance of their testimony if there were a trial on that issue?
The main substance of the testimony would focus on the information that he had en route to the call. It would not focus as much on the actual actions at the call. However, that would be subject to additional discovery as that is not yet complete.
Thank you.
Circling back, I see that I'm nearly out of time, but I'll be brief about this. Under Johnson and Kramer, the definition of killed in the line of duty was established, as noted before, and that definition endures today. Ultimately, in the statute, a key part of it, the statute reads, killed in the line of duty does not include deaths from natural causes except as provided in this subdivision. And an important piece here that was not highlighted by the ALJ was that Officer Grobner did not die from natural causes. Natural causes is not defined in the current statute. It was defined by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Johnson v. Plainview, where it held that where a heart attack is resulting in part from the physical and emotional stress associated with public safety officer activities, it's not a death from natural causes. So when there's not an exclusion excluding coverage for Department of Public Safety death benefits under Subdivision 3, it reverts to the longstanding case law definition in Johnson and Kramer, as I outlined previously. And based on that, Dr. Harrell's report is an unrebutted medical opinion that confirms that Officer Grobner was indeed killed in the line of duty and his death was not from natural causes. Thus, solely on the existing case law definition, he should be approved for in the line of duty death benefits for the Department of Public Safety. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you can go ahead and adjust the podium, get yourself set, and begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Corey Marsalek. I represent respondent, Commissioner of Public Safety, asking this court to affirm the ALJ's order denying ALJ's order denying relators death benefits request because there is no genuine issue of material fact that on this record, relator has not proven that they were engaged in non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical law enforcement activity within 24 hours of Officer Grobner's death. I'd like to begin, Judge Johnson, with your questions about the statute. Yes, I think applying the case law here would do violence to the statute because, as you mentioned, in 2016, the legislature took up the Supreme Court's invitation to amend the statute, and it did so by creating specific requirements for natural death, deaths from natural causes, and those deaths from natural causes require these certain requirements to be met. So that's why the Johnson definition of hazards peculiar to the peace officer does not apply here. And then to Relator's point about that this wasn't a natural death, and Johnson says that the statute and the case law, that the only case that has interpreted the statute, is inconsistent with that interpretation. And that is because the statute itself says that natural deaths are excluded except as provided by this subdivision, and then it articulates three manner of death that are covered by this subdivision. Included in that is the vascular rupture. And in the matter of Lannan at page 582, this court also opined that the statute speaks to accidental deaths and natural deaths, and then the ambiguity comes into play when it's something other than that. So what we're dealing with here under Lannan's articulation of how the statutory framework works is the unambiguous natural deaths that are covered. And here for a natural death to be covered, it has to be, then for natural death to be covered, one, it's a vascular rupture, which is specifically in the statute. And then two, it needs to be non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical law enforcement or emergency response activity within 24 hours of engaging in that activity. And then to the earlier questions about, to relators, the question that relator answered about whether non-routine modifies just law enforcement activity or all the other modifiers in the statute, I think the only way to read the statute is to say that it modifies all of those different activities. We cited Pollock for that proposition, and I think it's the only thing that makes sense, because as Judge Johnson was questioning about whether this was law enforcement activity, is this emergency response activity, I think there's many of those terms in the statute where multiple different activities could be covered. Something could be emergency response activity and be law enforcement activity. Something could be emergency response activity and be disaster relief or emergency medical services. I think that trying to parse out to say that non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical only modifies law enforcement activity would essentially render, it would, I think, I mean, emergency response activity is sort of a catch-all for the types of activity that are covered in this provision. And so by saying that non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical activity does not modify that catch-all provision, it renders the rest of the language in that provision superfluous.
This legislature's job is inherently not commonplace compared to our jobs. What, besides being shot at or discharging their own weapon, what is a non-routine activity?
Well, I think that's a complicated question that could be different in different scenarios. I think on this
so
record,
then why isn't that a fact question? If for resolution evidentiary hearing,
it could be, Your Honor, but I don't think it's so in this case because Relator had the opportunity to marshal evidence before the ALJ to show why this was non-routine activity. The best evidence that Relator marshaled was the report of Dr. Harrell, and Dr. Harrell's report, which is, I think, on pages 137 and 138 of the record, Dr. Harrell just says that, well, officers are inherently at a greater risk of suffering these cardiac causes because of the nature of their job.
But that, why isn't it a factual finding to say, on the way driving through neighborhoods, speeding very fast onto a domestic where there's a kid and a knife involved, why isn't that a fact question of whether that's non-routine?
Well, I think, like I said, on this record, it's speculative about whether that was non-routine because there was no evidence to suggest that this isn't the commonplace activity of a peace officer. And
I think that goes back to my question. Right. Like, what is non-routine then? You know, if it's not just if you're getting fired at or firing your gun, what else is non-routine? I mean, you can say everything what a police officer is doing is routine in their job. I mean, the ALJ said it didn't result in arrest. None of this. Isn't an arrest a routine activity? Like, why would that matter?
And I think in certain, well, I think that was just helpful support for the ALJ's ultimate conclusion. But I think, like, I understand Your Honor's question. I think it's difficult on this record to say what provide a be-all, end-all definition of routine is. I think it's sufficient to say that the evidence in this case was not sufficient to prove that it was non-routine. And I think that that's, you know, the modifiers, physical law enforcement activity, that has to mean something. It can't just be any physical law enforcement activity that is non-routine. So, like, I don't, to Your Honor's earlier statement about how what officers do is not commonplace for the rest of us, I agree 100%. But to say that any physical law enforcement activity is non-routine activity reads non-routine out of the statute. So it has to be something.
The ALJ imposed a standard by saying nothing in these facts paint a picture of exposure to the hazard of death. That's a very high standard, and that's way above non-routine.
Well, I think what the ALJ was trying to do there, he was trying to correlate. He was using the language from Johnson. That's what he was trying to do. And so he was trying to correlate non-routine with the language from Johnson. I don't necessarily think that the ALJ had to do that because I think the statute in respect to non-routine supersedes Johnson, and Johnson did not discuss this part of the statute because it didn't exist at that point. So the court had no occasion to opine on that. But I think the court was trying to help use a what it considered a helpful analogy to say, well, when I look at things that have happened in other cases, this is not that.
And there's nothing. Why is that not a factual finding that the ALJ is inappropriately making at that point to say, well, he seemed like he stayed calm?
Well, I think what the ALJ is doing there, he's watching the videos, which are in the record, and he's just describing what is in the videos. He's putting words to something that is a non-linguistic evidence.
But isn't that then go to the doctor's testimony about the sort of the stress that he's suppressing in that moment? We want police officers to remain calm. If he was freaking out on the way to a domestic with a kid and a knife, I don't think we want that officer out on duty.
Understood, Your Honor. I think that, but that goes back to answer that. One, Dr. Harrell's report is essentially saying that all officers are always subject to this inherent amount of stress that creates an elevated risk. That reads non-routine out of the statute because that has to be something more than the inherent risk that all officers face at all times. And so that goes back to the second part of my answer to your point is the fact that he's responding to this call and there's the Dr. Harrell report saying that this is inherently stressful, that yes, that is physical law enforcement activity, but physical law enforcement activity is modified by non-routine. And it has to be said, like, I agree that it's probably a very stressful situation. That doesn't make it a non-routine stressful situation in the context of physical law enforcement activity. And that's why on this record, the only evidence that Relator provided was that this is always inherently stressful. That read non-routine out of the statute, and that's why there is no genuine issue of material fact that this could be non-routine. And
do you have, did you have an expert, or is there an expert affidavit of yours in the record?
We did not. We relied on the statutory language. We said you take the ALJ, look at the record that the Relator has provided. On this record, there's no question of fact that this is not non-routine activity.
Were there any other affidavits, lay witness affidavits in the record?
No, not in this record.
Is there any other evidence, like documentary evidence about that might shed light on what is, you know, in the practice, stressful or strenuous, and what's routine and what's not non-routine in a law enforcement officer's life or work experience?
No, the only evidence in the record here is the evidence of what Officer Grobner did that day.
What about the affidavit of Officer Mollenhauer?
That was not before the ALJ. That was something that was disclosed subsequently in later discovery based off of, we had discovery deadlines that were coming up before the ALJ had issued its order. So that was part of that. That is not part of the record. That was before the ALJ. And again, that's something that could have been brought forward earlier if Relator were to argue that this is non-routine activity, this should go, like, instead what Relator argued was that essentially this was the Johnson-Kramer standard and we're covered. And that's not, one, that's not the standard, and two, there's no evidence in the record that this is non-routine activity.
But if you take the record in the light most favorable to the officer, how is the ALJ to make a finding that this was non-routine when the record has the doctor saying this was a very stressful situation? He was driving way over the speed limit to get to this scene. He gets to the scene, gets out of the car, and it's expecting somebody chasing a kid with a knife. Like, in the light most favorable to the non-moving party here, why is that not a non-routine situation that at least should move forward to an evidentiary hearing?
Well, honestly, Your Honor, I don't remember Dr. Harrell's report on page 137 and 138 addressing this specific situation. I recall Dr. Harrell addressing that that Officer Grobner had been on the SWAT team training squad in 2016, and he discussed, like, the inherent risks of being an officer. I don't recall Dr. Harrell expressly addressing anything that happened the final day of his death, which would make sense because Dr. Harrell's report was created before we received. So Dr. Harrell's report was, in my understanding, created in response to their request for workers' compensation. And then later when we got in discovery in the death benefits case, that's when we got the subpoena from Anoka County to get the actual details of what Officer Grobner's activities that day were. So Dr. Harrell didn't address any of this. Again, Officer Grobner's relator could have obtained this information presumably from Anoka, or they would have had a better opportunity to know about this information before the commissioner did, and they could have submitted that information to Dr. Harrell or asked for a supplemental report after getting this information. They relied on Dr. Harrell's report, which is purely speculative about the inherent risks that peace officers face. And again, inherent risks are not non-routine because it reads all physical law enforcement activity to be non-routine activity. And the statute has to mean something more than just the risks that peace officers face on a daily basis. And yes, I know Your Honor mentioned earlier about, well, does it mean they have to get shot at or something like that? No, it doesn't. there could be different factual scenarios where something could be non-routine. The point here is that there was nothing in the record for the ALJ to go on to suggest that this was non-routine activity.
Is there a fact question about the time of death?
We haven't disputed the time of death. We understand, like, I don't dispute relator's position that he was found at 5 o'clock, but it seemed like he had passed away earlier in the morning. We don't know the exact time of death. We haven't contested that. We've just considered the entire previous day's shift as all of the calls that led up to the 24 hours before his passing. So we haven't contested the time of death.
So we can consider the pursuit of the individual and the dogs looking for this person. That event can be part of this analysis.
It can be. That said, what the record shows is that Officer Grobner was not actually involved in the he was conducting the perimeter. He was securing the perimeter. He wasn't involved in actually searching out this individual. I think that was what I understood the record to say.
Respond to that event? Did he know he was doing just perimeter work?
I don't think the record articulates that. But again, I think that what the officer understands on his way to the call, that seems to me to go to the inherent stress of being in the job rather than what actually took place as far as because it's physical law enforcement activity. And that's the other part of it. So one, what the officer is doing, thinking on the way to the call, that seems to be more about the inherent stress of the job that happens on basically every call. And two, it has to be physical law enforcement activity. And I think the stress that an officer feels on their way to a call, that's not physical activity.
So your argument is non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical law enforcement. That entire phrase modifies everything that comes after.
No, non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical modifies all of the other words that come after it. So modifies physical law enforcement, it modifies law enforcement activity, and it modifies emergency response activity. So it would modify all of those provisions. I see my time has expired. If there are any further questions.
I had one follow-up question, Judge Schmidt. Mr. Marsolak, I think you said a little bit ago that kind of summing up, you said that none of the evidence proved or established the non-routine nature of the activity. My question is, which party has the burden on that issue?
I think ultimately the relator has the burden to prove that they're entitled to benefits.
Thank you.
None.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Go ahead and get settled again before you begin.
Your Honors, there's several points I'd like to address from the state's argumentation. First of all, there was a lot of discussion about that child with knife call. It sounds like we're now in agreement that that call was stressful. That previously was disputed in the briefs, but we have agreement there. And it just gets to, if it relates to that call, whether it was non-routine. The only evidence in the record is the affidavit that was referenced that indicates that this was a non-routine and stressful call. The state has offered no evidence to the contrary. And the state was looking to kind of split hairs over what Dr. Harrell said or didn't say in his report. But the thing to remember there is discovery is still open. The state never offered an expert report. Our expert rebuttal deadline hadn't yet occurred, and we never had the opportunity to submit one, again, because discovery is still open. These are all things that could be parsed out in better detail with complete access to discovery in this case.
Did you ask the ALJ to deny the motion on the ground that discovery was ongoing? And I guess a follow-up question, is there a procedure in the rules in OAH that's akin to Rule 54, I think it's 5406F or whatever it is? In other words, is there a procedure for the non-movement at OAH to request a denial or an extension in order to do more discovery? And if so, did you make such a request?
I don't specifically recall, but I know from the initial order there were still deadlines that it had not happened yet. So we had not had the full access to discovery. And it would be very relevant, especially relative to the manhunt call, where we have very little information about it. We don't have body camera footage. We don't know what was happening when Officer Grosvenor was dispatched to the call. We really have limited information because it was not provided in discovery, and that would be looked into in a lot more detail with the access to additional discovery in this case. But kind of shifting here, I want to circle back to the interpretation because it's important. The state referenced the 2016 amendment, and the key thing to remember there is the 2016 amendment to this Subdivision 3 expanded coverage for families of deceased first responders and public safety officers. Specifically, they looked to add a presumption of coverage if certain criteria was met, specifically regarding three specific heart conditions that would have a presumption of coverage. If you look back to this House file, specifically House File 2810, it was called the Hometown Heroes Act, and that's what led to that 2016 amendment. There was a lot of discussion when they're discussing that amendment about expanding coverage, making it easier for widows and widowers to obtain benefits. They discussed a problem at that time of why they were doing this is because they needed to conform the federal Department of Public Safety standard with the state standard, because what was happening is families would apply for both, get approved on the federal, denied on the state, and that was what the discussion called Catch-22 that they wanted to resolve and make it easier and avoid inconsistent determinations. So they added that presumption of coverage to make it easier for families and take the burden off of them to prove that the work activities were causally related to the condition, not contract coverage as the state is asking this court to interpret that statute.
Well, aren't there certain ways in which the statute limited relief as well? Like, for example, the 24-hour rule, which I think would, I mean, if that had existed at the time of, I think, the Johnson case, I think there would have been a different result. I mean, Johnson, I think, died 10 days after his last day of work. Or the requirement of non-routine, stressful, or strenuous physical, those conditions, I mean, aren't they limiting eligibility in a way that the Supreme Court case law did not?
No, Your Honor. Those are requirement criteria to satisfy a presumption of coverage. They're not a limitation on coverage. Ultimately, that limitation or that exclusion would only apply to a natural cause death. Johnson already defined what is not a natural cause death, and Officer Grosvenor certainly did not die of a natural cause death, just like the firefighters in the Johnson v. Plainview case did not die of natural causes. So I would agree, if there was a heart-related natural cause death, the only way DPS benefits could be compensable would be through satisfying the presumption criteria. However, when the death is not from natural causes, which is the case here, you can also receive compensability by establishing the killed in the line of duty standard that's been long articulated in Johnson and Kramer. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today and for the briefs that you submitted. We will get our opinion out within the statutory time frame. And with that, we are in recess.
Right.